Good morning. Welcome to the House Fraud Prevention and State Agency Oversight Committee. A quorum has been established. Today we are going to be discussing two important topics. First, we're going to hear the governor's fraud package that is kind of sprinkled throughout a lot of different bills and different committee jurisdictions. So we're going to try and look at the elements in all these different bills that deal with fraud. And following that, we're going to have a discussion on state charter schools. Earlier in the session, I thought it was important to ask our friends from the DFL what topics they were interested in, and this is one of the topics that they highlighted as a concern to them. So we will be doing both. So we are going to make this tight. There's a lot to get through. So I'm going to try my best. So we're going to give the first hour for the governor's fraud package, and then we hope to move at 9:15 or maybe at 9:30 at the latest to the charter school issue. So just so everyone's understanding how we have to keep moving along. So with that, we are going to approve the April 7th minutes. Representative Schultz, have you had time to review the minutes?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move adoption of the April 7th minutes.
Thank you. Representative Schultz moves the minutes from April 7th. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed, nay. The minutes from April 7th are adopted. All right, so first we're going to go to the governor's fraud package. And with that, we will start with Commissioner Gandhi and her team. Good morning, Commissioner Gandhi, Mr. Conley, Chief Inspector General Clark, and your colleague. Thank you for coming back to the committee. We look forward to your testimony on the governor's fraud proposals. Please state your name for the record.
Good morning, Chair Robbins, Lead Pinto, and committee members. My name is Shireen Gandhi, and I have the honor of serving as the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Human Services. Thank you for having me and us here again today. We all share the goals of ensuring taxpayer dollars are spent as intended and protecting vital services to the people of Minnesota. There is no tolerance for fraud in our programs. Governor Walz has put forward a strong set of program integrity proposals that tighten oversight across the life cycle of the Medicaid program, from how we design programs to provider enrollment, to enhance prepayment review of claims before they are paid, payment controls, and more sophisticated data analytics after payments are made. These proposals build on the work and learnings of more than 18 months of intense action focused on detecting and preventing fraud across Medicaid services, including the enhanced use of data analytics, on-site visits to providers, pausing licensure and enrollment of new businesses for some services, starting enhanced prepayment review of fee-for-service claims, and the work underway now to revalidate approximately 5,800 providers of high-risk services. I will walk through some of the highlights of the Governor's Program Integrity Proposals for the Department of Human Services, and I'm happy to take any questions you may have. I know time is short today, so I encourage you to dig deeper into the budget pages and reach out if you want more details. The DHS team welcomes the opportunity to collaborate on ideas for making Minnesota the best state in the country for Medicaid program integrity. Across the country, increasingly sophisticated fraud and abuse schemes threaten healthcare systems. Bad actors are adapting faster than ever, exposing gaps in aging technology, disconnected data, and manual processes that were built for a different era. This proposal incorporates comprehensive technology and data-driven enhancements to ensure providers, claims, and dollars are validated and accountable. It builds the technical foundation and expertise needed to sustain modern program integrity and support adaptability by investing in secure data infrastructure and interoperability tools. It includes modernization that will link licensing, enrollment, claims review, and auditing into a single framework. It enables us to use technology for enhanced prepayment review and post-payment analysis. It also builds staffing and modern data and analytics infrastructure that will allow the department to adapt to emerging fraud risks and support timely data-driven decision-making. This proposal also tightens program integrity in Minnesota healthcare programs, which cover more than 1 million people. There are three key elements to this proposal. First, the proposal gives the department more authority to assess and mitigate provider risk, establishing data-driven pre-enrollment risk assessment process to evaluate organization readiness, fiscal stability, compliance history, and more. Second, to meet federal requirements, the proposal also shortens the timelines for high-risk providers to respond to revalidation. The third element relates to managed care organizations. MCOs are critical partners in Minnesota's efforts to strengthen program integrity. They cover about 80% of enrollees and about 45% of Medicaid spending. This proposal sets out additional resources and requirements in state law to enhance state oversight of the contractual program integrity responsibilities of managed care organizations. It includes new requirements for MCOs to conduct prepayment review and implement all claims edits and policies the department uses for fee-for-service claims. It also adds staffing at DHS to enhance oversight of MCOs. Multiple strategies will also increase accountability for providers seeking reimbursement from state and federal government, and that payments reflect the services provided. Electronic visit verification, which is currently used for a limited number of services, is a system that tracks multiple data points, such as the location of the service, who provided the service, who received the service, and when it begins and ends. The proposal expands electronic visit verification to additional home and community-based services, some behavioral health services, and NEMT. Other key elements of the proposal include billing limits added to a number of services that you see listed here on the slide, or modified to mitigate the risk of overbilling. Elimination of remote services for some settings, and enhancements to MIN choices for providers to sign support plans that detail the services the provider is agreeing to provide. We are also proposing new reforms to strengthen oversight of integrated community supports so that services accurately reflect individual needs to reduce inappropriate billing, stabilize the provider market, and improve access to community integrated housing options. The proposal includes aligning rates with services by adding 15-minute billing unit for services and incorporating billing units based on acuity, ensuring distinct funding streams for housing and waiver services, requiring electronic visit verification I talked about earlier, enhancing oversight and documentation requirements, and implementing a moratorium for new providers in law. And lastly, our other program integrity proposals that I want to highlight are completing the implementation of the mental health uniform service standards that will move four mental health services listed on the slide from certifications to licenses. The funding shown will support administration of the new licensing standards. And secondly, expediting effective dates for better supportive housing. This proposal advances the certification requirement for recovery residences and the phase out of freestanding room and board programs effective July 1, 2026. Madam Chair, DHS welcomes questions on these proposals.
Thank you. I think we should go through, members, I think we should roll through the other provisions, and then if you are able to stay, we'll do questions at the end. All right. So with that, thank you for your testimony. We welcome Commissioner Erin Campbell and her team.
Surely we'll get through it otherwise.
Exactly. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and begin your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Erin Campbell. I'm the commissioner at Minnesota Management and Budget. Thank you for the opportunity to address the funding recommended for MMB and the governor's anti-fraud package, along with two enterprise proposals. To begin, the governor recommends $1.726 million in FY27 and $2.3 million in FY28 for 15 FTE for statewide internal control specialist and internal auditors within MMB. Director of Program Integrity Tim O'Malley's recently released Program Integrity Roadmap, Pillar 9, contains a consistent recommendation to expand MMB's oversight and verification capacity, including auditors. This additional staffing capacity will allow MMB to take a more active role with state agencies to design and implement corrective action plans and other internal control improvements within their operations and state programs, including the implementation of the Office of the Legislative Auditor's audit recommendations. It will also allow MMB to deploy internal auditors to test the operating effectiveness of these corrective actions. This would move the state government enterprise beyond the current self-attestation model and allow for ongoing independent validation of state agencies' implementations of OLA audit recommendations and other internal control improvements. This proposal was heard in the state government committee last week, and we hope this funding will be enacted in the budget bill this session. Next, an enterprise proposal would strengthen and make permanent payment withholding authority for state agencies that was enacted last session. Under this proposal, all state agencies would have the authority to withhold payments if a program participant is a subject of a credible allegation of fraud involving any program at their own agency or a program at another agency. Current authority is limited to withholding payments for possible fraud involving that particular program. The current authority compromise language that was enacted last year has not proven to be useful to state agencies and will expire in 2027. It requires a threshold of preponderance of the evidence to withhold payments. We propose the credible allegation standard, which aligns with existing authority granted to DHS and DCYF. The current law would seem to anticipate that the substantive and complete investigation would precede rather than follow withholding payments after a credible allegation of fraud. This proposal allows agencies to pause payments while an agency follows up on credible allegations of fraud. Program participants could request administrative reconsideration if subjected to a payment withhold. We are grateful for Chair Cleavorn and Chair Nash for hearing House File 3621 in the State Government Committee and for advancing it to the floor, and hope it can be taken up there in the remaining weeks of the legislative session. Any amount of fraud is, of course, too much, and it is important that all state agencies are given this tool to withhold payments at the point there is credible concern of fraud. Finally, the governor proposes a state inspector general to investigate and prevent fraud and misuse of public funds across state programs. I would acknowledge this is a topic Vice Chair Anderson and Representative Norris have devoted considerable attention to. In this session and the last, as well as Chair Nash and Cleavorn in the State Government Committee. The governor's proposal includes $15 million one time in FY27 to improve state agencies' data sharing capabilities. As criminals have developed more complex capabilities, it's more important than ever that we track connections across agencies and programs where red flags are raised. This legislation maintains all three agencies' IGs at MDE, DCYF, and DHS, while enhancing coordination and granting the state IG access to agency OIG investigative files. It also gives the state IG authority to direct and review an investigation. Finally, it empowers the state IG to set policy and procedure that agency IGs must follow. With that, I'll hand things over to Commissioner Gronfeld for the next slide.
Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good morning, Madam Chair. I'm Tamar Grunvall. I'm the Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Administration, and good morning to the committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to share the Department of Administration's portion of the Governor's anti-fraud package. This proposal enhances state agencies' ability to combat fraud and proactively remove bad actors from participating in the state's grants and procurement processes. The changes modify provisions in both the grant statute in Section 16B and procurement statute in 16C to remove eligibility if the recipient does not meet specific responsibility criteria. These provisions include many critical elements. Among them, first, that the entity is not currently suspended or debarred, and second, that none of its owners, officers, directors, managers, or controlling parties have a conviction of a felony financial crime that has occurred in the last 3 years. The responsibility provisions outlined also extend to subcontractors and subrecipients. The proposal also updates the definition of related entity. This expands the reach of agencies to protect against bad actors that attempt to get around state requirements by setting up new successor organizations under a different name or other types of restructuring to continue nefarious practices. The changes include ramifications for any false statement of compliance, including the ineligibility or termination of a contract, as well as subject the entity to suspension and debarment from receiving state grants and contracts. This proposal, along with other work the agencies are engaged in, such as coordination, collaboration, data sharing, and internal controls, these enhancements go a long way in providing the tools and legal supports the agencies need as they continue the critical work to protect taxpayer dollars. Finally, the prohibiting legislatively named grants, the changes here would ensure that all state-funded grants can be administered through a competitive process. It would also eliminate potential conflicts of interest that could exist between legislators and grantees. This is a recommendation from the Office of the Legislative Auditor and the state agency OIG Coordinating Council to end naming grantees in appropriations. This recommendation was also outlined in Tim O'Malley's recent report. Grants from the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund, legacy funds, and capital grants from general obligation bonds would be exempt from this requirement, as well as grants to tribes and political subdivisions would also be exempt. And that concludes my presentation.
Thank you. Thank you for coming. Next up, we have Drew Evans from the BCA. Good morning. Welcome to the committee, Superintendent Evans. Please state your name.
Good morning, members. Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Drew Evans. I'm the Superintendent of the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. There are a couple different aspects in the governor's both policy and bonding recommendations for you to consider this year that has been presented. The first is to increase funding to the BCA Financial Crimes and Fraud section. This is our Financial Crimes and Fraud section that does four things. They do insurance fraud, investigations, traditional financial crimes, fraud involving state government programs, and then wage theft investigations. Well, that is a large team. Certainly, there's some complexity to the continued schemes. This would really address frauds across the spectrum of those four programs, not specifically targeted on state program fraud. And what it would do is add eight additional full-time equivalents to the BCA, four of them being special agents and four of them being criminal intelligence analysts that would be focused on the financial aspect of examining these. So financial auditing and the different things that come with that, that we need to do our criminal investigations. We see a need to have additional analysts in particular to be able to assist us as we analyze these complex fraud schemes. The second are several policy proposals that we've been working through various committees. One is expanded subpoena authority. As these schemes continue to grow in their complexity, there's a number of different records that we need to be able to obtain as part of that, so it would expand the authority, basically the items that we'd be able to seek under administrative subpoena authority. As it sits in the House right now, there's been some tweaks to that that we've been working through that would allow us to get those records from there. It would broaden the definition of identity theft. We continue to see an expansion of AI in various frauds, and so this would include the use of AI to create somebody's likeness. We have examples that I don't have specifically in Minnesota, but that we've heard through our national meetings of people creating completely AI-generated individuals to seek and commit frauds through the use of AI. We'd also look at expanding the statute of limitations for a delineated list of various thefts and frauds that we use when we charge our cases, most of them from 3 years to 7 years under our bill. There's a few different versions of that floating around. Certainly, we expand the extension of the statute of limitations to ensure that people do not get away with committing frauds against our state government programs or any fraud, for that matter, under those statutes, simply the statute of limitations running. And then creating a new theft of public fund statute in that process. What this does is it makes it very clear if it's theft of public funds with some increased penalties associated with that. So, Madam Chair, I will be here as requested. That's an overview of that. If there are any questions the committee might have.
Great. Thank you very much for coming. Next, Commissioner Brown from Department of Children, Youth, and Families.
All right. Good morning, Chair Robbins, Lead Pinto, and members of the committee. I'm Tiki Brown, the Commissioner of the Department of Children, Youth, and Families. Thank you for having me here today to present the Department of Children, Youth, and Families portion of the Governor's Program Integrity Package. Access to affordable, high-quality child care is critical to the stability and economic success of Minnesota's families, businesses, and communities. The Child Care Assistance Program, or CCAP, currently supports the ability of parents to work or attend school for more than 23,000 children statewide on average each month. To strengthen program integrity for CCAP, the supplemental budget builds on the many previous program changes and investments that the governor has brought forward and that the legislature has enacted since 2019 by making additional investments that enhance fraud prevention and detection for CCAP. First, this proposal will increase the department's investigative capacity by adding a second team of six CCAP investigators to our existing team of five. Adding this new team will provide capacity for more proactive and unannounced site visits, in addition to supplementing the extensive work that the DCYF Office of Inspector General currently does to investigate tips, flags, and concerns. Second, the proposal would expand the department's ability to identify program integrity risks and track investigations. It includes funding for infrastructure, including introducing a single case management system for investigations. Collectively, the resources in this provision will expand opportunities for comparing data across programs using tools such as predictive analysis and advanced modeling and more effective investigative case management. Third, the governor's budget also recognizes the important role that local agencies play in program integrity and proposes an increase of approximately $800,000 per year for the Fraud Prevention Investigation, or FPI, grant. The FPI grant is available to counties and tribal nations to support their capacity for program integrity work. Currently, 85 counties participate in the FPI program, either as a single county or regional operations. They investigate fraud and public assistance programs administered by the Department of Human Services and DCYF, including the Child Care Assistance Program. The FPI grants can be used to prevent, identify, and investigate fraud in public benefit programs. And finally, the CCAP program integrity proposal would require all providers to complete program integrity training before they could register to receive CCAP. Training will be updated to remain current with CCAP policies as they change over time, and providers will need to repeat training at a cadence established by the agency. And that concludes my presentation. Thank you for the opportunity to present today.
Thank you for joining us. I'm sure we'll have some follow-up questions. Thank you. Next, we have Chelsea Olson from the Minnesota Council of Health Plans.
Okay,
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Chelsea Olson with the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, three trade association representing the nonprofit health insurers in Minnesota. That's Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Minnesota, Health Partners, Hennepin Health, Medica, and Sanford Health Plan of Minnesota. To note, UCARE was also formerly one of our members. Four of our members are managed care organizations that are contracted with DHS to administer health care benefits to our Minnesotans on Medicaid, also called Medical Assistance, or MA, and Minnesota Care. Those on Medicaid are currently served in two ways. First is that they could receive services through fee-for-service, where DHS pays claims directly. 15% of the Medicaid population is on fee-for-service, while 55% of Medicaid billing is through fee-for-service. 85% of Medicaid enrollees are served through MCOs or managed care organizations, which accounts for 45% of the funding. There are currently eight entities providing services to the 1,041,000 Minnesotans receiving care through managed care. The Council's health plan members cover around 931,000 Minnesotans, with the other 109,000 served through the three county-based purchasers. Our nonprofit health plans take program integrity very seriously, and we are committed to ensuring Minnesotans get the quality care for which they are eligible. And we are committed to the stewardship of Minnesota's premium dollars. Our ability to protect program integrity helps keep the cost of care more affordable for all. When we discuss program integrity, we don't just mean intentional fraud, but also waste and abuse. While our plans are continually adopting new and innovative solutions to catch and prevent waste, fraud, and abuse, this is a long-time core competency for Minnesota health plans in our commercial and in our managed care books of business. It's not a new fad or a response to recent news stories. As contracted vendors with DHS, we value the ability to partner with the state to ensure some of the most vulnerable populations receive care. Health plan contracts with DHS are posted publicly on the DHS website each year after contract negotiations have been finalized. Written into those contracts are plan obligations around program integrity and reporting requirements, which include the annual program integrity reports, which include investigation activities, prevention efforts, corrective actions, and results from the prior contract year. Each month, MCOs are required to submit detailed logs of fraud and abuse investigations. And before the 2026 plan amendment, this was done quarterly. Within 5 business days of an MCO knowing or suspecting fraud, they must notify DHS. And when an MCO determines a credible allegation of fraud and imposes a payment suspension, MCOs must submit a written referral to DHS and do this no later than the next business day. MCOs are also required to have special investigation units, or SIUs, they're dedicated to preventing and addressing fraud, waste, and abuse. Just like Medicaid enrollees vary by number in each MCO, the SAU teams also vary in size. Minimum SAU team staffing is set in contract by DHS and correlates to enrollee size. One of the unique features of having MCOs that are working in other lines of business is that the SAU teams are also able to draw on the expertise, best practices, and personnel from the commercial lines of business. Over the last year, DHS is working to implement a number of capabilities that MCOs have historically utilized, like pre-service authorizations, prepayment reviews, post-payment audits, and AI tools to support the review of records. MCOs also utilize innovative tactics to address the complexity of today's fraud. These might include research on social media, analysis of IP data, site visits, and employing staff with backgrounds in law enforcement and the FBI. CMS requires all states to submit managed care program annual reports, which are often referred to as the MACPAR. These reports are posted publicly each year around June. We compiled the MACPAR data for council member plans for 2024, but would like to note that the metrics for 2025 we anticipate to see an increase in. For 2024, council member plans have had 42 dedicated program integrity staff, over 2,000 opened and resolved program integrity investigations, 103 program integrity referrals to the state, and over $1 million in overpayment recovery. One of our member plans provided this helpful timeline illustrating what a typical SIU rapid response looks like, which takes about 30 to 45 days. So when fraud is flagged, the SIU BA or investigators conducts initial research and data analysis to identify questionable claims. This might take 5 to 10 business days. There may be an on-site record retrieval, site inspection, and provider interviews taking one business day. From there, there's administrative review that might include scanning records, reviewing case notes, initial record review, and preparation for the clinical and coding reviews, which takes about 3 to 4 business days. And then the clinical and coding review, which is a review of the medical records against what's been billed and whether what is being delivered is appropriate, may take around 10 business days. Then the SAU team will review and substantiate the findings and determine the course of action. This is then reviewed and approved by leadership, which may take 3 to 5 business days.
Thank you, Ms. Olson. I appreciate your testimony, and I want you to finish up, but if we maybe could move along a little faster, maybe we could skip the case studies and finish like the high-level overview. Thank you.
Absolutely. So then at this point, SAU leadership and legal teams review and can implement a payment suspension. So we'll skip through the case studies here on housing stabilization services and ARMS. I would like to skip to on March 9th, the program integrity director shared his investigation findings with this committee and stated that there's an opportunity here to partner with MCOs yet still oversee their activities. They have a vested interest in preventing fraud. And we completely agree with his assessment about the partnership opportunities for plans in the state and about our vested interest in preventing fraud. And then to wrap, the council is advocating for legislation that's being heard in the Health Committee this afternoon. This legislation includes provisions that will improve communication between MCOs and DHS, strengthen plans' ability to network with only quality providers, and perform the double checks on services and payments that are essential for catching waste, fraud, and abuse. We are also committed to working with the legislature on our joint goal of ensuring program integrity, which is why we invited this committee as well as the Health and Human Services Committee to join our SAU teams for a Program Integrity 101 later this month, where members will be able to ask their in-depth questions of the SAU teams and hear about the good work they do every day. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there any member of the public who wanted to testify about the governor's fraud package? Okay, then we are going to go on to member discussion, and I am going to invite back up, I think, sorry, I'm going to ask a question first. Commissioner Gandhi, and I think it's Commissioner Campbell, I'm trying to recall where we were in the presentation. Whoever wants to talk about the new definition of fraud and credible allegations of fraud, that piece of it. Thank you. So this is one of my concerns as I was looking through this. We've had a lot of discussion over years about when there's a credible allegation of fraud and when you can take action based on that. And so in the definition that's being proposed by the governor's package, credible allegation of fraud means an allegation of fraud that has been verified by the head of an agency. And that to me is very concerning because that suggests that there's already been an investigation, whereas I think what we had always been concerned about is that when there's a real allegation of fraud, you can take action even if there hasn't been a thorough investigation. So can you tell me why we're using that language that has been verified? And how you think what verified will mean.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Erin Campbell from MMB. I'm joined by my colleague, Chris McNulty, who is our general counsel. This is the language that we tried to get passed last year. What we ended up with is a weaker standard that we think actually does require that we do those investigations on the front end, and that has proven to be problematic and not useful. So what we're coming back with this year is something that we believe is stronger, will be more useful, and is in line with language that some of our partner agencies already have at DCOIF and MDE, I believe,
in which they have been able to use that authority to withhold payments in the last year upwards of 500 times. So having said that, if you don't mind, I'll defer to my colleague, Mr. McNulty, to who is an attorney and I am not, to provide a bit more detail.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name.
Thank you. My name is Chris McNulty. I'm General Counsel for Minnesota Management and Budget. And members of the committee, I think Commissioner Campbell did a great job explaining the thought process behind this. And I think that, again, so the current language with preponderance of evidence, in sort of layman's terms, that means that it's more likely than not fraud has already been committed. Preponderance of the evidence is more than a 50-50 chance. And the terminology used here, a credible allegation of fraud has been verified. What the intent of that is that the allegation has been verified, that there is some base level of credibility. So, for instance, and it gives some examples, like if there is a complaint that on its face seems credible, then that would be a credible allegation of fraud, which is then actionable by the agency. And so I think in order to alleviate some of the concerns I think that you are raising, there are examples here specific, so including but not limited to fraud complaints, patterns through audits, information through civil cases, any information. But I think that the verified language is merely to verify that there is some sort of information indicating that there may be fraud occurring.
Thank you, and I agree with your intent, but my concern is that has been verified is going to hamstring us. So example, whistleblower reports, not there, in your not limited to, right? And there have been multiple whistleblower reports from inside these agencies that should be, I think, taken seriously. There have been multiple whistleblower reports, hundreds from the MCOs, from whistleblowers to me that have said they've been ghosted. So I'm concerned that it says has been verified, and obviously we're not going to solve that here, but I want to get this on the record and continue to work on it. And I would encourage you to also work with the Office of Legislative Auditor on this language and see what they would suggest, because I think I appreciate that you felt the preponderance of evidence standard wasn't working for you, and that you're trying again. So I appreciate that we're continuing to try to get the best language, but I found this rather concerning. I think a reasonable person standard might be something, you know, that should be considered. And with that, I'd like to invite Chair Cleavorn to comment.
I have a question about that, your comment, just for clarity, since I've authored the bill. So what would lead you to believe that the whistleblower information would not lead to a credible allegation? So it starts somewhere, right? So I don't see them as being mutually exclusive. I see one leading to the other. So could you please help me maybe understand that a little better?
Yes, so for example, I've seen hundreds of whistleblower reports over the last 14 months or however long we've been doing this. Some are credible, some are not. But the credible is not what I'm concerned about. It's that it has to be verified, and we haven't defined what verified means. And so there have been hundreds of whistleblower reports that I have found to be credible, that the U.S. Attorney's Office has found to be credible, that other people have found to be credible, that to date have been previously ignored by the agencies or ghosted or not responded to. And so I want to make sure that as we're developing this language around credible allegation of fraud, that we are not requiring such a narrow band for what verified means, that it's precluding things that, under a reasonable person standard, people would think is credible.
Okay, let me ask.
It seems to imply the investigation has to happen on the front end. Okay. Chair Claiborne.
Just one question. So are these the whistleblower allegations that we have not seen yet, or are these, I haven't seen these, so I would, if you have those, I would love to see those so that I can work to better improve this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further comments on this? Otherwise, we have a lot of questions piling up here.
I will, Madam Chair, members, I will just say that we're happy to work on this legislation. What is important to us, I want to be clear that from our legal analysis, it does not require investigation on the front end. That is what we are trying to avoid. What we want to get passed, what the governor feels very strongly about, is that we get legislation passed that actually puts us in a position to be able to withhold payments, and that's not where we are today for most agencies. And a few of the members, Chair Nyhash, Chair Cleburne, have been very helpful the course of the last year in trying to get this done, so we'll continue to work with them on that.
Terrific, and I appreciate that, and we all share that goal. So maybe just specifying that it doesn't require an investigation in order to be a credible allegation of fraud would help us accomplish our shared goal. Thank you. All right, Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Campbell, you want to stay for a moment? Got a question for you, for starters. This is an improvement. What we're working from is an improvement from current law, and yet I think that members around this committee would be referencing it and looking at Director O'Malley's report and noticing that there are several different things that were recommended in his report that aren't included in the proposal. In fact, as I was kind of just hashing through it during this presentation, it almost felt like almost half of it was left by the wayside from Director O'Malley's report. But Commissioner Campbell, I'll come back to our first, or the last time that you were in front of this committee, and I heard some positive conversation about this through the presentations, but how does this budget proposal improve the data sharing across all of state agencies so that we are able to see when there is fraud that is being committed against one particular department and how that's being effectively communicated so it's being stopped in another department?
Commissioner Campbell.
Madam Chair, is this question about the payment withholding language specifically or about more general? Okay.
No. Madam Chair,
yes, Representative.
For further clarity for you, Commissioner Campbell, this is about data sharing across state agencies, right? One of the things that we've talked about is how there are convicted fraudsters who are currently today still receiving money from state government. And one of the things that we discussed the last time that you were in front of this committee is that we still lack the ability to shut off the money, but more so and more importantly, that the information about convicted fraudsters and those who are going through a process where we are evaluating a credible allegation of fraud, that's not being effectively communicated to other parts of state agencies. It's why I ask you this question, right? As that final stop, the question is information being shared to other state agencies when there's a credible allegation of fraud? And what does this specific proposal proposed by the governor, what does it do to ensure that data sharing is effectively happening across state agencies?
Commissioner Campbell.
Madam Chair, Representative Schultz, so data sharing is addressed in a couple of the governor's legislative proposals, hence my question. In the proposal that we were just discussing, the payment withholding language, that allows for, if there's a credible allegation of fraud in one agency, it then allows for another agency who is maybe granting money to that same recipient to also withhold payments in that instance. I can tell you that right now, all of the allegations of fraud that go to the BCA are coming to MMB, and we are distributing them to agencies for their follow-up. So that is happening right now. I would say not in like the most efficient way, thanks to some of my team members who process all of those things. So that is happening. What it is not able to happen right now is that we're not able to withhold payments in those instances, mm-hmm. unless they are happening at places like DHS, MDE, and DCYF that already have stronger language around payment withholding. There is also an element around data sharing in the governor's OIG proposal. Mm-hmm. I have my colleague Brandon here from Minit who can speak to some of those data sharing questions.
Yes, welcome to the committee. Please state your name.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Schultz. My name is Brandon Hirsch, Deputy Commissioner for Minnesota IT Services. As Commissioner Campbell referenced, included on slide 12 There at the bottom is the one-time investments to improve capabilities for agencies to improve, to build capabilities within their systems that better enhance identity and access verification. So an individual applying for programs, we have, and the market's made available more mature capabilities to identify individual's identity. Also included in that proposal is money that agencies could utilize for their agency-based systems to improve the tools that they have to share data across systems, recognizing that, the language the legislature passed last year to provide agencies authority to share data was an important step in this right direction. We also need the tools to operationalize that work, and that's what those funds are intended to do.
Madam Chair, if I could just reference, that was 13.357, if you want to look at that we passed in the state government bill last year, Co-Chair Nash and I, 13.357.
Thank you. Right? Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It sounds like we're making some headway on this, though it seems like this is an area that needs to be focused upon as we head towards the end of the legislative session, that there be additional conversation that happens there. I think that might be the end of my questions for Commissioner Campbell. Madam Chair, just kind of want to wonder, like, should we just keep her in front of us if other members have questions for her?
Sure.
I just want to be efficient.
Yes, I have Representative Anderson.
Thank you. I have one follow-up for both of you. Is that the universal identifiers? Because there are things. We just got this. We're trying to put this together with O'Malley's. And in one of his recommendations, which I think is very good, is to employ universal identifiers for both recipients and providers. So is that what you were talking about? And are you going full scale with your request, to do that? Or
Mr. Hirsch.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, the capability specifically that we're talking about in terms of identity verification is a tool that is already being deployed across programs at many agencies. It's called Login MN. Mm-hmm. And it on a longer path, yes, would have an ability to help us get there. This is a tool that has to be adopted on a case-by-case basis for every application. So paid leave is using this capability to have individuals, when they're applying for benefits, they work through this identity verification. We will need to make that integration happen at every application, and we're working through prioritizing the key public-facing programs that can utilize that benefit to the largest degree. But it's a large-scale effort to put that modern capability in place. This funding will help us get there and help us move faster on those priority programs. But it'll be a journey as we integrate that capability across all state services.
Just how long of a journey?
It'll be multi-
'cause I use this system. It works with my business. So this shouldn't take that long. It's not that hard.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson. It will be a multi-year journey to cover all agencies and all programs across state government. But as I mentioned, we're working through those prioritized programs that will most significantly benefit and reduce the state's risk, where we really want to make sure that we have the highest levels of identity verification. So as I mentioned, paid leave has adopted a mature capability in this space and is proving incredibly effective at catching some nefarious actors. We have a number of systems at the Department of Human Services that are working on implementation now. And longer down the road, some of those less critical applications will also be included, which is why I mentioned that it's a multi-year
journey. Okay, thank you.
Okay, Lee Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just briefly following up on your questions about the credible allegation of fraud definition, just noting that, and I guess Representative Schultz had brought this out, that this is actually a lowering of the standard, making it easier to go after that. I gather the administration had advanced that last year. One thing I want to point out is that somebody has to do the verification, like whatever standard you choose. I think reasonable person standard probably is pretty similar to the term credible. But regardless, somebody has to make that decision. And so if it weren't going to be the head of a state agency, then we'd need to think of who else would do that. but having it be that you don't have to go through a court, don't have to do through various other things, does seem like it streamlines the process. I understand your concern, Madam Chair. Potentially, I mean, anybody who does it, you've got a concern about who would do it, but if it wasn't going to be the head of the agency, we'd need to find somebody else. So I appreciate the chairs Cleaverne and Nash advancing this. I gather it's on the general register, so hopefully we'll be moving pretty soon, but thank you for your work, and I'm glad that this is going to be another step forward. Thanks.
Thank you. Representative Altendorf.
Madam Chair, I had a question for Commissioner Brown. I don't know.
Okay, well, just hang on then. I have one more for Commissioner Campbell before she steps away. So I'm interested in sort of the thresholds. And so in the bill you reference, and in your testimony you referenced how we're going to not only look at the provider, but all the owners, operators, related people on the board, et cetera, et cetera. I think that's good. I don't know why we haven't been doing that so far. And that's been one of the problems we've seen in our web of fraud that we've constructed, is that people share ownership, or ownership hasn't been verified of who's investing in some of these companies. So I'm glad to see you're doing it. But one of the concerns I have is that on the bill, I don't even know what bill we're on, but 4883 in the section about debarment, it's vague. And so I'm not sure why we just don't say if someone has been convicted of this, that they cannot be a state vendor anymore. Currently it says in section 9.6 and following, debarment means disqualification of a vendor or related entity for a specified time commensurate with the seriousness of the offense, the failure or the inadequacy of the performance. And then related in another area, you talk about suspension.
Madam Chair, I think you want admin, not MMB.
Okay, perhaps. But I think it's very important that we get this right, and that another place it says a false statement may result in suspension or disbarment. And I just have to say, when I read all these bills all this weekend, everywhere I go, it's still not strong accountability. And to Mr. O'Malley's report, I mean, that's the thing we need. And I wanted to talk about MMB specifically, because when you testified before a committee in January, you talked about how you don't see accountability as your role, that you see coming alongside and supporting agencies so they can be successful as your role. And I'd like to know, does this change any of that? Because in your presentation, you talked about you want to take design and implement corrective action plans. That's good. But where is the accountability? Are we going to still rely on self-attestation by commissioners? Is anyone going to get fired? This is what Minnesotans want to know. Where is the accountability in these proposals?
Madam Chair, I think that the statewide OIG proposal adds accountability. Relative to MMB's role in the internal control space, it continues to be the case that there will be self-attestation, but we will, assuming that it is funded, it will be funded in a way that allows us to be much more involved in helping agencies resolve these issues. I will say that following the hearing that you're referencing, I had a number of conversations about what it would look like, including with Mr. O'Malley and with the state auditor, about what it would look like for MMB to have the accountability that you're talking about. Nobody had any ideas about what that would look like. And if you do, I would be more than happy to have a conversation with you about what that would look like. I talked to members of this committee about that, and it was the determination that that is not MMB's role, and that the thing that we can do, that both Mr. O'Malley and Auditor Randall, I don't want to speak for either of them, but what I heard them say that they thought we could do is directly in line with what you see in the governor's proposal around adding capacity to the internal controls team. I would be more than happy to have a continued conversation with you if you have an idea about what that would look like, but nothing has come to me about what that ultimately would be.
Madam Chair.
Thank you. Chair Cleaborne, I'm going to finish my conversation with Commissioner Campbell. So thank you for that, Commissioner Campbell. I have not had a conversation with you. I don't know who you spoke with on our committee, but you did not reach out to me. And I think it's paramount because you and your office have the responsibility for internal controls in the state of Minnesota across all agencies, that there is real accountability. The public is fed up with everyone being helped to comply instead of actually being held accountable. And Mr. O'Malley talked about this extensively in his report, and I don't see that same attention to accountability and culture change that we still need. It's very concerning to me that you are going to continue to rely on attestation. My concern is that if there are findings where these programs are being mismanaged to the point that we saw in the hearing last week where agency officials were falsifying and backdating documents, there should be real accountability for that. There should be consequences. And the notion that we're going to go through all this and still rely on self-attestation and not have the agency responsible for internal controls continue to say you don't have a way to provide accountability is shocking, which is why we need the independent OIG, because we cannot do this from the legislature, reach into the executive branch. And if you are not willing to do your responsibility under statute, then we absolutely have to create this independent agency. Thank you.
Can I?
Vice Chair Anderson.
Thank you. The responsibility for this is the governor's office. The commissioner of MMB, although they do have some HR, but they can do so much. And I appreciate that you followed O'Malley's recommendations and you got this. But only the governor can deal with the other commissioners, okay? So that if there are problems with other commissioners, with staff, it is the governor's office and the governor's job to deal with this. The MMB commissioner cannot force, other commissioners to do what they should be doing anyway. They can help, they can do whatever, but they can't force it. But that is the reason, too, that we need the independent OIG. And I know what happened last year with the OIG, okay, and it's the governor's office, helped by House Democrats, to kill the independent Office of Inspector General. Okay, I hope that that doesn't happen again.
That's not
because
true.
The OIG needs to be independent from the governor's office. We have seen that through all of this. There's a duplication where, all the new folks that they're saying would go to VCA. That is the job of the OIG, the independent OIG. That is a complete duplication in this proposal. So I want to just point that out. And even an independent OIG cannot force commissioners to do their job. The governor hires these commissioners, and he has to be the one to do it. So we're going to have a new governor, and no matter who that person is, I think they are going to, spend all their time cleaning this mess up, and they should. So thank you.
Madam Chair.
Thank you. I'm sorry. Chair Cleaborne, you were not on the witness list.
Don't talk.
We're here to hear from the governor's people. If you would like to come back and testify, if you have something small to add, but interrupting every single time we have a question is inappropriate. And I'm sure you wouldn't tolerate that in your committee, Madam Chair. So I will entertain one last comment, and then I'll invite you to come back perhaps for a future hearing.
Thank you. And the only reason I'm here this morning is because my bill was posted with no notification. So I did not know that my bill was being heard this morning in your committee. And as chair with jurisdiction over these things, I would like to level set just a moment for this committee. In 2023-2024, we passed extensive grant requirements. We created an Office of Grants Management. We did pre-risk award assessments. We did more detailed agreements required. We did mandatory reporting. We did progress reports. We did investigating and oversight. And as I'm hearing you, We are building upon the work in 2023 and 2024 that House Republicans all voted against. You voted against these things. And now we're trying to improve them, and you're still saying it's not enough. I would welcome a conversation with you to make my bill better, but to just say that we're not interested is not factual. And to say
thank you, Chair Cleavorn. We're going to move on. All right. I think we wanted the Department of Administration to come forward. And to clarify while she's coming forward, we have been fighting for these things, and the things that passed in 2023, including progress reports, did not yield any results, which is why we need things that have teeth in them. Because progress reports, in fact, we know were falsified or backdated. So it's not working. Welcome back, Commissioner Granvall. I believe Vice Chair Anderson, you had a question? Or no, it was Representative Eltendorf. Did you want to I'm sorry.
Administration.
Did someone else have a question for Commissioner Granvall from admin? I guess it was related to my concern about debarment and the time it takes and why we're not having permanent debarment. Could you speak to that? Why is this effort about debarment so vague?
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. I will offer Assistant Commissioner Betsy Hayes, who has oversight over the grants area, to provide a little bit more context to this question.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Betsy Hayes. I'm an Assistant Commissioner with the Department of Administration. The points about debarment, one thing I wanted to mention, you had indicated that, it seemed that it was, why not just say they can't do business with the state? And so I would point to lines 11.20. The debarment that you referenced is simply the definition that's in the statute. But when something that's new in statute is that we do say affirmatively that simply a vendor is not eligible to receive an award, and that is covered with procurement on line 1120 and earlier also pertains to grants. So this is different in the sense that in the past, when something would come to our attention, we would have the ability, the discretion with the May to pursue suspension or debarment, but this makes the authority more proactive, that simply they cannot do business, they cannot receive an award or a grant if they're suspended or debarred, along with the other items listed under the definition of what makes up a responsible entity.
Thank you, I appreciate that, and I do think it's stronger, but then at the end of that section it says, the false statement of compliance may result in ineligibility or termination of a contract and may result in suspension or debarment. So there's still quite a bit of wiggle room there and in the previous section in 9.6. So I just encourage you, I think the public wants zero tolerance. And we still do not have that in the statute that I'm seeing. And so while we still have the opportunity to change things as we're going along, because as you said, we are writing the statutes right now. I encourage you to have a zero tolerance policy.
Madam Chair.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On this very topic, I know that that has been a conversation across the table with regards to our vendors. And so my question for the commissioner is, with the statute or these citations and this legislation, my question for you is, does that only apply to a certain part of people who have contracts with the state, or is it very broad across all of state agencies? Because my concern is that the same debarment principles that we're discussing right now aren't going to apply to vendors within the Department of Human Services, where we have seen such huge fraud within the Medicaid-funded programs.
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Representative Schultz, my understanding is that this is an expansion and building on the prior expansion that Chair Cleavorn talked about, and it's continuing to bring in anybody doing any kind of business with the state. And I will also give Assistant Commissioner Betsy Hayes the ability to answer that question, too.
Thank you. Assistant Commissioner Hayes.
Madam Chair, representatives, this particular bill here covers grants and procurement. So to the extent that the Department of Human Services is issuing the money via a grant or a procurement contract, it would apply there as well.
Commissioner Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just be very quick here. And I'd say I think this is one of those other areas that we need to focus on before the end of this session, because it needs, I believe it needs to apply specifically within the Department of Human Services and the Department of Children, Youth, and Families, with its own accountability measures, with its, you know, with full enforcement action. Because I, what I'm hearing is too much, and this, and I don't even think it's the intention of the agency, mm-hmm. but it is, it's this perspective that, where there's really no teeth, no tools for total enforcement and accountability. And I think that that's where we as a legislature really need to get to, and I think that there's some bipartisan work to be done there.
Yes, I agree. All right, thank you. I guess, Commissioner Gandhi, if you would mind, I'm sorry. Oh, someone on the list. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and actually following up on Representative Schultz's point, and I have a question, but in the interest of time, it may be more of an offline conversation, because I think that what I appreciate about the whole plan is how it really does sort of cover both the agencies where we have seen the most work happening, and also the business model of fraud really targeting it. And also it is aware, and I think when we look at particularly at admin, of all, we want to, and I think this committee would all agree, strengthen and sort of harden the target across every entity and agency and across every way that we could be targeting, that fraudsters could target our systems, that not just Medicaid fraud, not just CCAP, but every place. And so the place I've been working on, and I appreciate Representative Schultz's help, is on this issue of how do we ensure that in places where we have found the kinds of fraud, particularly misclassification fraud, fraud on the on the UI trust fund, fraud in PFML, fraud on all of the ways that when you misclassify a worker, you deprive our public coffers and public programs and defraud our public coffers and public programs. I have a bill that you helped me work on, House File 3093, that passed out of committee, State Gov. We talked about it a week or two ago before deadline. And I'm wondering, one, is that language incorporated in your proposal? And two, would you be willing to do it? Because I think adding the minimum criteria into the grant, into 16B, one, is a stronger tooth in terms of if you've already been had a some citation from some other branch of government, it seems like we shouldn't be giving you any grants. And so I'm wondering, one, if it's already baked in, I haven't seen the language yet, and two, if that's something you'd be willing to talk about.
Commissioner?
I'm going to defer to the Assistant Commissioner Betsy Hayes. Thank you.
Thank you. Assistant Commissioner Hayes.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Representative Greenman, the provision on line 10.3 with regards to responsibility is similar to the language in your bill. The language in your bill is more specific. You have many provisions listed out that cite specific statutes. It captures a lot of labor items like prevailing wage requirements. So those are not listed verbatim in here, but they are captured in essence with more of a general provision that that all laws have been complied with. So it captures it in that regard, but not as specific. And we certainly would be happy to speak with you or work with others to see if there's improvements we could make to the language.
Thank you. Thank you. All right, Vice Chair Anderson. We're going to invite Commissioner Gandhi up. Thank you very much. Welcome back to the committee, Representative Eltendorf.
Madam Chair, I had a question for Commissioner Brown.
Sorry, we will get her next. I believe there were questions for Commissioner Gandhi, yes?
Yes. Vice Chair Anderson.
Thank you. I have a question on the, I'm going back to O'Malley's report, because I believe that if we just implement all of O'Malley's recommendations, we will solve 90% of this problem. We should be doing it as quickly as possible. There's a couple things. He talks about providers must maintain records at a single accessible location, with agencies having immediate access to those, and also employing cameras, real-time electronic sign-ins, real-time monitoring tools. Is any of that in the governor's recommendations?
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Robbins, Vice Chair Anderson, thank you for the question. I agree. O'Malley's report is strong, and the nine pillars he lays out very much align with the government accountability handbook and, along with compliance programs. I have looked at our program integrity proposals, and they touch almost every one of the nine pillars. So there are probably more things that can be done, but this is what we came up with at this point in time. Electronic visit verification is one of the examples, and there are other requirements for billing documentation across our proposals, and I want to see if Inspector General Clark has anything in specific he would like to bring up, or Deputy Commissioner Connolly.
Thank you. As to why they weren't included then, because these recommendations then are not, from what I can see and what you just said, they're not included in the governor's fraud package.
Commissioner Gandhi, or whoever you want to respond to that.
Chair Robbins, Vice Chair Anderson, I'm saying that many are included. I would need to have a complete crosswalk in front of me, but when I looked through our program integrity proposals, I have items that fall into every single bucket.
Vice Chair Anderson.
Thank you. Specifically, providers must keep the records accessible at any time immediately to agency. They must have the records. And that I don't think is here. I mean, I look at what happened couple of different programs that you started licensing, and all of a sudden 90% of the providers are gone. Okay, and I don't know if they followed the Feeding Our Future guy back to wherever it happened yesterday or whatever, but they're gone and they're not renewing their licenses. And I see the work you're doing now with these 5,800 or 6,800 providers. A huge chunk of them are not even applying, or they've been, so it's like we have started to actually require documentation, real documentation, and I would argue that licensing wasn't even that strong, okay. But we started to require it, and all of a sudden, the main fraudsters, they're gone. And this single thing here, by providing records that they have to be provided at a single location, like any other business, okay, a real business, and they have to have be able to see them without advance notice. But I don't see it in here as a recommendation.
So is that part of the governor's package, Commissioner Gandhi?
Chair Robbins, Representative Anderson, it is. I was reading all the language last night, and okay. So it is there. I want to see if there's specifics in terms of, is it everywhere we want it to be? But I know it is there.
Mr. Conley.
Chair Robbins, Vice Chair Anderson, just three quick points. So I think on the point about providers not choosing to kind of be revalidated, or the impact of a different work with respect to licensure, I think specifically within EIDBI, we haven't yet reached those deadlines. We'll acknowledge a lot of providers have not yet been responsive. But, I think at this point it's too early to say whether or not 90% of providers have chosen not to re-enroll with us. The second thing I would say is that Medicaid now requires providers to have available documentation upon request. That is an existing requirement. I would love more conversation with the committee about how we strengthen that, specifically in state statute, but that is a present requirement. And currently we are undergoing a focused review with CMS in which we're having to yield or to provide that documentation to CMS. The third thing I would say is on the EVV requirements, or the different components related to EVV in the governor's budget, those I think cover a lot of the the time and sort of location and rendering provider, I think questions that you're raising here about providers. If you have other elements, again, with respect to observing the delivery of services or verifying those in electronic ways, we're open to conversation about that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. All right, Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So in both the agency's presentation and in the plan's presentations, there are allusions to required periodic reports from the MCOs to the agency and to CMS related to suspected fraud. I have been trying to get my hands on those reports, which are presumably public, for at least 2 months now, and the data has not been forthcoming from either the agency or the plans. And I think that that's data that, public data that this agency ought to have at its disposal. I guess what I'm looking for is a commitment that those reports will be made available to the committee in a reasonable amount of time.
Commissioner Gandhi? Inspector General Clark?
Chair Robbins, Representative Elkins, I am happy, I was unaware of those requests. I'm happy to get you any information that you need that is public and that I can provide to you. What I will say, it is true that the reports I've seen are these monthly case level reporting.
Yep.
So the list of kind of all the businesses that MCOs are investigating, what they're investigating, and kind of dates of investigations. So to the extent that is public, the Data Practices Act allows us to get it to you, I'm happy to get that to you.
Yeah, there's that one, and then there's an annual program integrity report that is comes out at the end of April. Everything comes out as soon as we're past deadlines. But
exactly.
But the last year's report would be helpful, the annual one.
I'll work to get you what I can.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, and I thank you for bringing that up, Representative Elkins. I have a list as well of reports that are required from not only DHS but other agencies that have not been provided to the legislature, sometimes in more than 2 years. And so we had that conversation when we had a previous hearing, but the list I found is much more extensive than I realized. So I think we can work together on making sure that those reports happen. It is statutorily required. So as Commissioner Brown is making her way to the testifier table, I just want to ask about this theft of public funds, which is a new provision in the governor's fraud proposal. And my concern about this is in the language, it says failure to perform is not evidence of intent not to perform unless corroborated by other evidences. And I understand that because someone may be intending to perform and then they go out of business or something happens, but if they get sick or they have to close down or whatever, the failure to perform still, even if it was unintentional, still means they were getting paid. So what are we doing about failure to perform when they still get paid? Are we recouping that money? So I think there's a gray area in here that's not being addressed. Commissioner Gandhi.
Thank you, Chair Robbins. Happy to look at that in more depth.
Thank you. And quickly, like we should have a conversation about that. That happens throughout this statute, and I think it's very concerning. Okay, thank you, Commissioner Brown. Welcome to the committee. Representative Eltendorf, thank you for your patience.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. Didn't mean to make this so long awaited. But my question is then on the recommendations that's going to DCYF. I heard you say, and in the proposal, that they're increasing, I believe it was six, you know, new full-time investigators. And do you agree with that, or do you think that there's, in the modern-day technology that we have, ways to do modernization? The O'Malley report specifically said employing cameras, you know, going to some more electronic-type methods, I believe, for the state would cost less in the long term. And so I just wanted to know if you agreed with that or if you had some insight on that.
Commissioner Brown.
Thank you, Chair and members. I do agree that we do need additional staff to do more proactive unannounced visits, and I think the staffing will absolutely help with that. There are a number of other measures that that will also enhance the capabilities of staff, as they are, as you mentioned, some of the technology capabilities, some of which are built into this proposal. We have found, I think, over the last year or so that some of the improvements that we have made within the agency, many siloed data elements. We have worked on consolidating those data elements to be more proactively able to look at red flag reports and then deploy teams to review in person and validate that information. So I think it's a combination of both, in person and then also electronic means. I also have the Inspector General with me that can speak a little bit more to the camera technologies that you mentioned.
Representative Altentorf.
Madam Chair, yes, I guess, you know, this does not seem, we're always growing government, we're always growing bureaucracy. Right now, we're adding into this proposal more people, which are a very expensive to the state of Minnesota, when we could be doing things that are being suggested is cameras. There's all sorts of technology, and the state is embracing hiring more people. I don't hear from daycare providers that they want to be inspected more. The good daycare providers are doing a great job in the state of Minnesota, and we can improve the program integrity by doing it on the front end. So the proposal is on the back end. It's investigating after fraud has already happened. What I am saying is we're putting our time, our energy, our resources in the wrong spot. The money should be on the front end to get the to stop any bad people with intent that are doing things illegally, fraudulently. We can get it on the front end, and that part is very disappointing to me, so I don't know if they have a comment on that, but it's putting our dollars absolutely in the wrong spot.
Thank you, and I encourage you to follow up because we need to move on to the charter school piece. So with that, we appreciate everyone from the governor's team being here. We appreciate your efforts to work on fraud prevention, and we look forward to continuing to get these legislation in proper shape. So with that, we'd like to welcome everyone to the testifier table who's up on charter schools. We will start with the government relations gentleman from the Department of Education, Adash, and then go to Mr. Orfield, and then Nelson Inez, and someone from Zoom. So if the Zoom person is out there, please be on deck. Adash, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Adash Uni. I am the Director of Government Relations for the Minnesota Department of Education. And just to expedite the process, I won't project my presentation. I know everybody has it in their packets. It's quite short. But I'll just go through. I was invited to just provide a short overview of what charter schools are, what authorizers are, and MDE's role in the charter space. Just to go in your packets on slide 2, we start with what charter schools are. They are independent schools that parents and students choose to attend and open to all students and do not charge tuition. Currently, there's 173 charter schools in operation in Minnesota, serving approximately 70,000 pre-kindergarten through grade 12 students. The primary purpose of charter schools in Minnesota is to improve learning, achievement, and success of all students, and some of the features include employing licensed teachers, programming for students requiring special education services, and having their students take the required state MCA assessments. And for statutes, just to be clear, for statutes and rules to apply to a charter school, just like they do to a school district, the statute or rule must specifically apply to them or be included in the charter chapter 124E, which is the specific charter school statute as well as the one that contains statutes on authorizers. Charter schools do receive most state funding, aids, and grants as if they were a district. There are revenue streams like levy and facilities, for example, that charter schools do not receive. And to reserve students in Minnesota, a charter school must have an authorizer. So what are authorizers? Authorizers can be school boards, intermediate districts, other education districts, charitable organizations, institutions of higher education, nonprofit corporations, subject to Chapter 317A, or single-purpose authorizers. Entities seeking to be an authorizer would apply to MDE under an established process. The approved application will be on the basis that they the application that is approved by MDE then is carried on into our evaluation process for the term and duration of them being authorizers. And broadly, authorizers ensure that charter schools have the autonomy granted by statute, fulfill the purposes of the charter that's contained in their charter contract, and are accountable going forward to those contracts. More specifically, the authorizer is responsible for establishing that initial performance contract with the charter school, determining if a charter school is ready to open. This is done through an affidavit process with the charter school developers and includes a market need and demand study. Authorizers must then get approval for this new charter school with the department. They also provide oversight and evaluation of charter schools in the areas of academic, operational, and financial performance. And then review proposed changes to charter schools in their portfolio, such as site and grade expansions and site changes and more. And just to be clear, site changes and grade expansions do require approval from the commissioner. And finally, they determine the renewal, non-renewal, or termination of the contract, if that is appropriate. Finally, where does MDE sit in this space? In addition to statutorily required charter school specific oversight that's laid out in Chapter 124E, MDE provides general oversight of public education programs, just like it does for school districts. So we provide oversight and guidance administration of programs like school finance, nutrition programs, federal title programs, special education, our Compass assistance team, academic standards, and college and career success. We do have a charter center, a dedicated charter team at the department, and they help provide guidance and oversight of authorizers to ensure they're implementing their authorized plans as approved. And the oversight includes our authorizer performance evaluation system, which is our MAPE system. We review their annual reports and a range of other financial and operational documents and plans from them, as well as I mentioned, their applications for new charters for site and grade expansions as well. And then we have ongoing guidance for authorizers and charter schools through our charter school boot camp. And then finally, if there are complaints regarding a charter school or authorizer that may have violated Chapter 124E, we do review those complaints as well.
Thank you very much. Mr. Orfield, thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Myron Orfield. I am the Earl R. Larson Professor of Civil Rights and Civil Liberties at the University of Minnesota Law School, former member of the legislature 25 years ago, voted for charter schools. My research has been particularly about the performance of charter schools vis-a-vis public schools and their levels of racial segregation. And I published 4 peer-reviewed articles on that subject. My findings are similar to others. In the course of my research, one of the things that we've noted is that charters are often fragile and close a lot. On an average year, about 300 to 500 kids show up for school, for a charter school that isn't opened. And looking into the reasons why charter schools close, a lot of the times it's related to fraud and mismanagement. In some ways, the greatest authority on this subject is a group of investigative reporters from the Star Tribune, who in the last year and a half published about 20 stories about charter school mismanagement, fraud, and poor performance, and suggested a number of reforms to the legislature. Jeff Metroit, Mara Clocker. Very good research. I wish that it were mine. I wish I could take credit for it. But it pointed out that in the last 6 years, one of their articles, and I sent about 20 of the articles to the committee, they said that charter schools have virtually no financial oversight. And in the previous 6 years, they said at least 16 charter schools were closed after allegations of fraud or other misconduct on the part of employees. Dozens of other charters plagued by financial misconduct have closed over the past 3 decades, including 4 failures this year. This is an article dated September 14th, 2024. In my efforts to look at the charter school closures, the public record's incomplete. But the best that I could do, looking at 39 charter schools that were closed since 1995, were that 14 for which I could find reasons for the closure in the public record, 4 were closed as a result of criminal prosecutions for fraud. Another 7 involved very serious financial mismanagement or irregularities, which came near the threshold of illegality. Only 3 of the charter schools that I could find in the public record that were closed did not have any allegations of fraud. They were just simply other particular issues. So the vast majority, there's a very incomplete public record. One of the important studies Star Tribune covered extensively over the years was the Harvest Prep Network of charter schools. In that case, Eric Mahmood, the head of that charter school, was representing for many years his charter school was doing better than the Edina public schools, which are an excellent series of public schools. As the testing system became more regularized, as it became computerized and less susceptible to manipulation, his scores fell 20 points 1 year and 20 points the next year, fell dramatically. The Star Tribune noted that throughout the period he was paying himself in excess and his family in excess of $350,000 a year. He owned the building that was the leased back to the charter school, the Seed Academy, owned the catering service. He was paying his wife his substantial salary and his children substantial salaries. He received a $6 million grant to build a residential academy, the Synergy Residential Academy. That was never built. There was no action ever taken to build that school. Nothing ever happened. $6 million was given to him, never accounted for, never looked at, disappeared into the public record. And even though the Star Tribune and Steve Brandt of the Star Tribune repeatedly publicized this, nothing was ever done. It seemed like a complete failure of regulation. In the process of this very extensive study of charter school fraud by the Star Tribune, again, which is not my work, but is the work of the Star Tribune, they asked for the public records of the charter school and the financial management, and they filed a legal case. They asked under the Data Practices Act for the financial records and the number of complaints, over 2,000 complaints that related to financial mismanagement. And the department refused to grant that request. They denied the request of the Star Tribune to do that. So that is a big, it's a big murky disappearance. It's hard to know. So, I mean,
thank you. We have a couple more testifiers. If you could wrap it up so yes. We can have time for discussion.
Yeah. The last thing that is part of my research is the ability of charter schools to send kids to college, and many of them sell themselves in the competitive marketplace as institutions that send kids to college. And our research, looking at the state longitudinal educational data set, 20 of the 30 worst high schools in the Twin Cities at sending kids to college are charter schools, and many of them are called things like College Prep, Metro College Prep, Hmong College Prep, Minnesota Internship, and College Academy. These are schools that send virtually no one to college. Maybe, you know, many of them are 0%, the highest in this list. And the bottom 30 is 10%, often selling themselves. If that's a form of fraud, I leave it to the committee to decide. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Inns.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair.
Oh, thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to be here. My name is Nelson Inns. I have worked for over 20 years as a classroom teacher, including time in charter schools. And I served for 8 years on the Minneapolis School Board, including as chair and finance chair. I also have 2 children who attend Minneapolis Public Schools. I started my career in education as a volunteer at Washburn High School in Minneapolis. At the time, Governor Pawlenty was talking about waste in public schools, and I wanted to see for myself what he was talking about. What I saw was not waste, but inspiring people working incredibly hard without enough support to do their best for kids. To a person, when I told my colleagues and my neighbors and my friends that I would be here today, missing work for the first time in 2 years, they were all excited. And they all had things they wanted me to make sure I mentioned. In fact, my principal, Diana Bledsoe, wanted me to mention her name as a potential auditor of charter schools. That should tell you how strongly people feel about these issues. When the charter school law was first passed 30 years ago, it may have seemed like deregulation and limited oversight of public education was a good idea. It is clear now that charter schools have created serious problems for the people of Minnesota. At some point, we have to be honest. When you build a public system on deregulation and limited oversight, you shouldn't be surprised when it produces waste, manipulation, and corruption. That's not a rarity in this system at all. It's the inevitable result of it, whether we intended it or not. There are the obvious examples, millions of dollars of public money lost in cases like the hedge fund scandal at Hmong Academy, schools leasing buildings to themselves at inflated costs, and high salaries flowing to connected individuals. We've also seen increased segregation and concentration of poverty. These stories show up in the news again and again. But what is most frustrating for those of us working in public schools is how this system impacts students, teachers, and families on a day-to-day basis. Though it's just the tip of the iceberg, I'd like to highlight how we fund special education and how that system harms our neediest kids. Special education funding operates as a cost reimbursement system. Schools provide services based on what a student needs, and those costs are partially reimbursed by the state and federal government. But that reimbursement does not cover the full costs. Districts are required to make up the difference using general education funds. This gap is often referred to as the cross subsidy. Recently, there were efforts at the legislature to reduce the burden of the cross subsidy, but even those have been scaled back. As a result, public school districts continue to absorb significant costs just to meet their legal and ethical obligations to serve special education students. On top of that is how costs are shared between districts. When a student who lives in Minneapolis or St. Paul, Owatonna, Grand Rapids, or Watertown attends a charter school or another district, the home district can be billed for a portion of that student's special education services, even if that student has never attended that district's school. In other words, one school determines what services are needed, and another system pays for those services. That structure creates opportunities for manipulation without transparency or accountability. We are often told that public schools spend too much per student. In Minneapolis, that criticism comes up all the time. Yet, we have specialty charter programs like Spiro Academy effectively spending upwards of $60,000 per student, funded in large part by Minneapolis public school dollars. So when people would come to me and say, why don't we have middle school athletics, for example, and we're financing $60,000 per student at Spiro Academy, I don't know what to tell them. While districts like ours are criticized for our spending, could you imagine if Minneapolis Parks got to send the bill to Eden Prairie for every person who came to Minnehaha Falls from Eden Prairie? What do you think that bill would look like?
Please wrap it up. We have one more testifier.
Okay. Beyond funding, there's some real questions about access and accountability. As a board member, I wondered where the public outcry was when charter schools suspended students at high rates, manipulated education settings so that students could not legally attend, or simply told families that their needs were too great to be served at their school. Where's the outcry when these disparities exist? Where are people storming the board meetings at charter schools? When will legislators call out the inequities when some schools operate with special education caseloads as low as 7 students, while in public schools, we are responsible for more than double that, often while teaching full schedules? I think I probably already gotten too wonky about all the mechanics, but I'll say that whatever discussion we have here today is, as I said, just the tip of the iceberg.
Thank you.
The system allows for a level of inconsistency and lack of oversight that
should
not be
acceptable.
Thank you.
We really need to move on.
Thank you, Madam
Chair. To our next testifier, Joey Sinian. Forgive me if I've mispronounced it.
No problem. Thank you. My name is Joey Chenyon. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Association of Charter Schools. We serve approximately 170 charter public schools and over 70,000 students across the state. Charter schools are public schools that are free, fair, and open to all. Charters have no enrollment barriers to any family who wants to enroll their children, including all students with IEPs. And once they are full, they have a randomized lottery. Charters are subject to the Human Rights Law, the People Fair Dismissal Act, the Data Practices Law, and Open Meeting Law. Charters are subject to the same federal and state requirements to provide special education services and are subject to the same financial audits, audit procedures, and audit requirements as traditional public school districts. Charters are held in compliance by time-bound legal contracts with authorizers, who in turn are held accountable by MDE. If they do not fulfill their contract, they can be closed and sometimes all. Charters are designed to meet community needs of students and families with innovative and personalized programs across the state, with community boards that only or that have publicly elected local parents, teachers, and community members serving. Most Minnesota charters are small operations, and many have teacher-powered leadership structures. Many of our schools are among the highest performing in the state, and many are beat-the-odds schools. Compared to state averages, chartered public schools enroll a larger percentage of EL students, a larger percentage of students of color and indigenous students, and a larger percentage of students who qualify for free and reduced lunch. To serve these diverse groups of students, many of our schools have unique missions, from credit recovery to re-engagement to language immersion to special education-focused programs, demonstrating that quality can take many forms when it's grounded in student need. Charter schools, just like any other types of public schools or government entities, sometimes have individuals who make mistakes or break the law. Let me be emphatically clear. Any conflict of interest, fraud, or diversion of resources away from students is unacceptable. Our organization and our sector strongly condemns any unacceptable behavior or misuse of public funds. Individuals who engage in this behavior must be held accountable and prosecuted vigorously. We expect authorizers and the Minnesota Department of Education to continue to enforce the law and hold schools accountable when issues arise. Charter schools are public schools, but we take seriously our responsibility to protect both students and public funds.
Thank you.
It's also important to recognize that I'm almost done. I'll finish up here. It's also important to recognize that Minnesota's charter sector has not stood still. Over the last three bienniums, we've worked in partnership with community partners, Department of Education, and authorizers to pass dozens of extensive and multifaceted bipartisan accountability and transparency reforms that are now being implemented statewide.
Right. Thank you. I just have a couple minutes, so we're going to move on. Lead Pinto, did you have comments?
No, Madam Chair. Hopefully we could come back later to have, I know we're about to run out of time, but if we can come back later for some discussion and questions, that sort of thing, next week or otherwise. I know that you've got a number of things planned, but given that we've been so squeezed here, hopefully we can do that. That's all.
Yes. Representative Nash.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Just wanted to level set. I don't do education policy, but I do have a charter school in my district that I work with regularly. And just a question, is it not true that the inspection, financial oversight, and compliance of charter schools fall to the responsibility of MDE and the authorizers?
I believe that is correct. From the department, Mr. Univ, forgive me if I'm saying that wrong.
Yeah, yes, Mr. Uni, Department of Education. Chair Robbins, Representative Nash, that's correct. So the oversight of a charter school would lie first and foremost with the authorizer, and the department, as I mentioned, has some role in there.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So to that end, would it also be fair to say that the lack of oversight may have resulted in some of the failings that we've seen, that you just don't bother looking at charter schools because you may not find them to be your cup of tea? I mean, anybody who's charged with overseeing something and then we find examples of it not being oversight, to me that causes me to want to say, why didn't we look at it and where did the finger get pointed backwards to? If MDE is charged with this and MDE apparently didn't do it, find it, or find it early, I find that to be troubling. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Nash. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I really appreciate this conversation, and just for this committee that over a year and a half has been looking at some of these structural issues. I do hope we can come back next week and sort of amongst the committee talk about it. What we are seeing described is the same issue we've seen of when we outsource both the provision, the public, we're looking at private providers, right, nonprofits and others, that then are overseen by an outsourced oversight, these authorizers, that then we have added this additional layer of government. And we see that in other areas when we talk about MCOs, when we talk about all of the ways that we have created systems where the business model of fraud and waste and abuse happens. But the lack of transparency, the outsourcing to the authorizers, isn't just about MDE's cup of tea. It's about how over 30 years the legislature has created a system that is not where public transparency and public oversight that we see on the school boards aren't happening in these authorizers. And like reading the Star Tribune and then saying under state law, authorizers are free to establish their own oversight framework. Like that's not how we should do things. And so I think our job, and I think this committee is pretty uniquely situated to talk not just about the sort of educational outcomes, which are other committees for, but about the structural problems that we see, because we now have expertise in seeing that in other areas of government. And I hope we can come back and talk about those sort of structural issues of private providers and outsourced oversight, and how it's playing out in where we're hearing millions of dollars of state dollars, fraud state dollars, and also kids who are showing up and having their doors closed, which is not how the kids of Minneapolis should be treated, or of Minnesota, excuse me, should be treated.
Thank you, Representative Greenman, and thank you to all our testifiers. I will try to find more time for further discussion on this, and I would just like to close by saying I really think this is, in some ways, a good model. When there's been failure, they close down. When providers have been found to do fraudulent things, they've been closed down. And that's not what we've seen in DHS and other areas. So I think there is more oversight clearly by the department who's charged with overseeing these authorizers. Obviously, we could make changes to how the authorizers are structured. Many things we could do. But I think a good reminder is that when there's failure, there's accountability. And we need that across all state agencies. Thank you. We are adjourned.